From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many of the people given long prison sentences under the Get Tough Drug Laws of the 70s and 80s are now returning to society with no money, little education, and no job skills. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Elaine Bartlett, who served 16 years for a first-time drug offense. The new book, Life on the Outside, describes the difficulties she's faced returning to the outside world. We'll also hear from the author of the book, journalist Jennifer Gonerman, and we'll talk with Albany County DA Paul Klein, who supports mandatory minimum sentences. His father was the judge who sentenced Bartlett. Also, we talk with Simon Sebag Montefiore, author of Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the Americanization of Benjamin Franklin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Saddam Hussein will be transferred to Iraqi legal custody tomorrow, although the U.S. military will retain physical control of him. It's the first step toward putting the ousted Iraqi dictator on trial. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
Saddam's trial isn't expected until probably next year. After he's legally transferred to Iraqi custody, he's expected to be taken in front of a judge on Thursday. He's likely to be charged with a dozen counts of crimes against humanity, including using chemical weapons against a Kurdish town, violently suppressing a Shiite uprising, and invading Kuwait in 1990. 11 other prisoners will have their legal custody shifted to Iraq as well. They include Tariq Aziz, Iraq's former foreign minister, and a man involved in chemical weapons use known as Chemical Ali. All these top-level prisoners will remain physically in U.S. custody. Iraq's interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, says that's because Iraq doesn't have a suitable prison. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
The Supreme Court ruled today that the government may not enforce a law designed to protect children from being exposed to pornography on the Internet. In a 5-4 decision, the court said the law probably violates the Constitution and sent the case back to a lower court for trial. The law would require website operators to use credit cards or adult access codes to keep children from getting access to pornographic sites. Supporters of the law say it's just an extension of laws that keep pornography away from minors in other situations, such as sex shops. Opponents say the law could also be used against artists and sex educators. The Pentagon has announced the formation of a military tribunal to try three terrorism suspects being held at the U.S. base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Pentagon officials say the decision to announce the tribunal had nothing to do with the Supreme Court's ruling that almost 600 prisoners at the base could challenge their detentions in American courts. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The Pentagon says that the tribunal will be comprised of five military officers. The presiding officer is retired Army Colonel Peter Brownback, who spent more than 30 years as a military lawyer, then judge. The Pentagon did not name the other officers. The tribunal will hear the cases of three detainees from Yemen, Sudan, and Australia who have been charged with conspiracy to commit war crimes and other offenses. The three were picked up in Afghanistan. So far, they are the only detainees who have been charged. Their trials will be held at the Guantanamo Naval Base, but it has not been decided which defendant will be tried first. The Pentagon did not say when the cases will be heard, but defense officials say they would like to have them underway by the end of the year. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow gained 56 to close at 10,413. The Nasdaq was up 15 to 2035. This is NPR News. The Cassini spacecraft appears to be in perfect health as it makes its final approach to the planet Saturn. The probe must fire its engine on cue tomorrow night in order to go into orbit around the ringed planet. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Cassini has traversed more than 2 billion miles of space. It has gotten a gravity assist by slinging around Venus, the Earth, and Jupiter on its 6-year flight. And now success depends on a critical rocket firing. Project officials Julie Webster and Robert Mitchell told reporters that they've done everything they can think of to make sure the spacecraft is in perfect shape.
It's just looking very solid. But it's looking very good.
You don't need that.
Knock on wood, if and when that rocket engine fires, Cassini will be the first spacecraft ever to go in orbit around Saturn. Its 4-year mission will be to explore the planet, its rings, and its fascinating moons. Richard Harris, NPR News, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
The U.S. has expelled two Iranian security guards from Iran's mission to the United Nations. U.S. officials say the guards were photographing and videotaping New York landmarks, bridges, and parts of the subway system. A State Department spokesman said it was the third time that the U.S. has sent Iranian guards home because of, quote, activity inconsistent with their official duties. That's diplomatic code for spying. There's no U.S. law against filming in public places, but foreign diplomats can be expelled for relatively little cause. The U.S. has no diplomatic relations with Iran, but Iranian diplomats represent their country at the U.N. The two men left the U.S. over the weekend. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Elaine Bartlett, a single mother of four, was given the sentence of 20 years to life in 1983 for selling 4 ounces of cocaine. It was a first-time drug offense. She says she needed money and was talked into transporting and selling the cocaine by a man who turned out to be a police informant. 16 years later, at the age of 42, she was granted clemency by Governor George Pataki. The new book, Life on the Outside, describes the difficulty she's faced returning to the outside world. The book was written by journalist Jennifer Gonerman, who is also my guest. Gonerman says we are now witnessing the long-term consequences of the get-tough policies in the war on drugs. Many of the long prison terms from the 70s and 80s have ended. Men and women, like Elaine Bartlett, scarred from the years behind bars, are trying to re-enter society with no money, few job skills, and little education. Last week, the American Bar Association published a report saying mandatory minimum sentences for small-time drug offenders are unfair and should be abolished. Bartlett's tough sentence was part of the Rockefeller drug laws, which were passed in New York in 1973. I asked Gonerman to describe the law.
New York State's drug laws, known as the Rockefeller drug laws because they were created by then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller in 1973, really helped to kick off the nation's war on drugs by establishing a system of mandatory minimum sentences so that anybody in New York State who was convicted of selling at least 2 ounces or possessing at least 4 ounces of heroin or cocaine would receive a mandatory sentence of 15 to life minimum. In Elaine's case, the judge added 5 extra years, and that's why she got 20 to life. But with the mandatory minimum drug laws, it doesn't matter whether the defendant is a kingpin, a first-time offender, just a drug mule. The level of involvement has nothing to do with the length of a sentence. The only thing that determines the length of a sentence is the weight of the drugs involved.
The laws were created for the kingpins. There was no way to prove that I was a kingpin. Nothing in my life stated that I was a kingpin. At the time I was arrested, I was 26 years old, mother of four, on welfare. I had $5 in my pocket when I was arrested. I didn't own anything. I didn't have anything. So when they did an investigation on me, there was nothing to warrant that I lived the lifestyle of a kingpin, so I couldn't understand why the judge would sentence me a first-time offender with 20 to life.
Jennifer Gonerman, what was the philosophy behind the Rockefeller laws?
I'm not sure whether there was a really well-thought-out philosophy behind them. At this time, Nelson Rockefeller had been governor of New York State for a while and repeatedly tried to win the Republican nomination for president without luck. And essentially, he was trying to shore up his conservative credentials so that he could win that presidential nomination. And I think he viewed the Rockefeller drug laws, which were going to be the strictest in the entire country, as a way to try to get those credentials and put himself onto the national stage. And in fact, what he did do was launch a real shift in crime control policy for the entire country. Virtually every state copied New York State's drug laws and passed their own version of mandatory minimum sentencing.
When you went to prison, Elaine, you had 4 children.
Yes.
They were young. They were ages 1, 2, 6, and 9. Both their parents were in jail. Your mother initially took care of your children when you were imprisoned. Was she in a good position to do that?
Not really. She wasn't. But It was never a question as to whether my mother was going to take my children or not. That's just the type of woman that she was. And once I got arrested, I had to notify her and let her know that I was locked up, so automatically she took care of my children. My mother raised 13 grands because I had a couple of sisters and brothers that were strung out on drugs and not capable of taking care of their own children, so she took on their kids, too.
Your mother died when you were in prison. How many years had you been in prison when she died?
I had been in prison almost 14 years when my mother started really getting sick, and she died in 1998.
So there was still like a year or two left
for
you in prison before you got out. So who took over the parenting of your children?
My younger sister stepped up and took some of the younger kids out the household that needed taking care. And my son, Apache, gave up his basketball scholarship and came back home and took on the responsibility of being a parent.
Were your children getting in trouble while you were in prison?
My son, Jamal, my youngest son, Jamal, started getting into trouble at a very young age. I'd say about the age of 12, he started getting into little trouble, and then it led to other things. And when I came home from prison, I had to go to jail to see my son, who was locked up for selling drugs.
How old was he when he was convicted?
Jamal was about 16.
Now, do you blame your own imprisonment? Do you blame your absence for his troubles and for the other problems that your children had? Or do you think that, you know, some of this might have happened anyways? I mean, you know, you I know you were talked into it, but still you were involved in a drug cell, and your boyfriend, who became your husband, had been selling drugs, so it's not something that was unknown to the family.
For me, of course, I blame myself some, but I don't blame myself to whereas I feel helpless, because I could have been home and the same type of things could have happened. But I feel that when they sentenced us under the Rockefeller drug lords for such a long period of time, you not only sentenced the person or the mother that's being convicted, you sentenced the whole family. Because my children had to come see me in prison for 16 years, so everything they know about me is what we shared in the visiting room. And basically, what you're telling our children, that it's all right, that prison is all right, it's a way of life, it's all right to accept that, and it's not. And you would think that me receiving a 20-year-life sentence, that none of my children would have got involved with drugs or been in jail. For a mother to come home after 16 years and basically the love that you have for your family is what keeps you strong and alive and help you to survive them 16 years and not go crazy, not lose your mind, and not become dependent on any type of medication just to make it through the day while you're locked up. That's the hardest thing for a mother to deal with.
What effect do you think it had on your children to visit you in prison? Some people would think, like, what a great deterrent. Who would ever want to go to prison after seeing what life is like for their mother behind bars? Do you think it scared them? You know, the whole Scared Straight program, where you take young children to prison just to see how horrible it is. The theory is that they'll be so appalled and afraid that they'll stay away from crime. So what effect do you think it had on your kids to visit you in prison?
I think that it made them feel hopeless. My kids never stopped loving me. Even though I was locked up for such a long period of time, they still carried the love that they had for me. I still carried the love that I had for them. And when you're in prison, you live in two worlds. Because when you come down to the visiting room, you basically try to make the best of them 6, 7, or 8 hours of whatever time you have to spend with your family. You don't talk about what your everyday life in prison is like. I made a mistake in my life. I'm not saying that I'm not guilty of delivering that package. Yes, I did that, and that's what I did. But me delivering a package, did it really deserve for me to sit in prison for 16 years? Did my family deserve to be affected psychologically, mentally, and the fact that they have no hope, no dreams? Do you know what it is? My mother didn't want me to go to prison. It's not that we raise our children to go out there and get involved in drugs and sell drugs. I hear people talk about in our communities, our kids are not on the street selling drugs. Of course your kids are not on the street selling drugs. In your communities, your kids have different options.
When you got out of prison, your children were 16 years older than they were when you went
right.
in. So your children who had been 1, 2, 6, and 9 were now 17, 18, 22, and 25. Did you feel like you knew them when you saw them after prison?
To be honest with you, in prison, I felt like I really knew them. But once I got home, no, I didn't know them. We was complete strangers. And my youngest daughter, Nene, whose name is Elaine, like mine, she said to me, she said, who are you to come home and tell me what to do with my life and what's not right with my life after 16 years? You abandoned me. You left me. You shouldn't have never went to jail in the first place. So you didn't care. So who are you to come home and tell me what to do now? She feels that my mother was her mother, which is right, because I birthed her, but my mother raised her. So she'll say to me, my mother is dead. You're my biological mother, but you're not my mother. My mother died.
That must not make you feel very good.
It doesn't make me feel good. And when I came out of prison, you know, I had people tell me, Elaine, they teenagers now. You know, they're not young no more. You can't change what happened. Just walk away. But for a mother to come out here and see that your family has became stuck, that your family has basically just given up on life, how can you just walk away from a situation like that? I'm not saying that I created the whole situation, but I did play a major part in the situation. So how do you walk away?
Jennifer Gonerman, your new book is about Elaine Bartlett and her life in and outside prison. What are some of the parts of her story about her return from prison back to her home, back to her family? Parts of that story that you think are kind of typical of other people's stories when they get out of prison?
There's many ways in which Elaine's homecoming is very typical, other ways in which it's atypical.
Mm-hmm.
The tensions and resentment that she was talking a bit about with her daughters, the attitude of where have you, you know, why should we be listening to you? Where have you been for 16 years? You know, we got along fine without you, not really making a place for her anymore. I think that's very, very typical of people coming home from prison, this sense of role loss. I mean, Elaine tried very hard to reclaim her role as head of the family. When she first came home, the house was a disaster area. The family was in shambles. So I think regaining that respect, that authority, reclaiming the role of head of household is something that's pretty common with men and women coming out of prison. And it creates, obviously, a great deal of tension. And I think is part of the reason why many people end up back in prison. I mean, when we talk about the recidivism rates, which is incredibly high, you know, you often hear about people relapsing, using drugs again, or committing other crimes, and that's all obviously true. But there are a great deal of parole violations which stem out of family dysfunction or family tensions. Also, you have one family member telling another family member, you know, if you don't do this or that, I'm going to call your parole officer on you. And parole becomes a kind of second invisible punishment, a way for one family member to have power or control over another family member.
President Bush has proposed a $300 million prison reentry initiative to expand job training and placement services and provide transitional counseling. Jennifer, what are your thoughts on that proposal?
Well, he announced that proposal, you know, in January at his State of the Union address, and I thought it was fantastic that he was addressing what I think is a very, very crucial major national political issue. But I don't think $300 million even begins to tackle the issue. You know, we now spend about $55 billion a year on our prison system. Virtually all of that money, of course, is used to lock people up, and virtually none of it is used to turn people back from prisoners back into civilians. So I'm glad that he's starting to think about ways in which to ease these transitions. The federal government is putting more and more money into that, but I think we have a long way to go until we make that happen. I mean, I think preparing people to reenter society needs to start from the moment that they enter the prison system.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Elaine Bartlett, Jennifer Gonerman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elaine Bartlett is the subject of the new book, Life on the Outside. Jennifer Gonerman is the author of the book. Coming up, Paul Klein, the DA in New York's Albany County, he supports tough drug laws. His father was the judge who sentenced Bartlett. This is Fresh Air. We just heard from Elaine Bartlett, who was given a sentence she considers extremely harsh as a result of New York State's Rockefeller drug laws, which imposed long mandatory minimum sentences. Bartlett served 16 years of a 20-years-to-life sentence for a felony drug conviction. My guest Paul Klein is the DA in New York's Albany County. Klein supports the Rockefeller drug laws. His father, Albany County Judge John Klein, presided over Elaine Bartlett's trial and handed her the 20-years-to-life sentence. Since we were just talking with Elaine Bartlett, let's look at her case as an example. This was a first-time drug offense. She was convinced to participate in this drug sale by a police informant. And it was 4 ounces of cocaine that she carried for him. She did 16 years in prison. If this case were coming to you now, what would you want to see her prison sentence be? What would you want to see the case be?
Well, I think it would be handled exactly the same way as it was. Bear in mind, she met with a bunch of police officers who were purportedly buying drugs. She negotiated the price. Her boyfriend at the time had a previous arrest for an A1 felony drug sale. She was actively involved in the negotiation of the sale of the drugs, and in return for her participation in the offense, she fully expected to be paid $2,500. Now, it was not a smart choice which she made to get involved in the sale of the drugs. And when she was charged with that offense, she was offered a plea bargain of a plea to an A2 felony, which was the lowest allowable plea under the Rockefeller drug laws, with an expected sentence of 5 years to life. And she rejected that plea bargain and took her case to trial under the theory that she was not guilty of an offense. The jury disagreed with her, and then she found herself in the unenviable position of standing convicted of a Class A1 drug felony.
I think it was unimaginable to her. I think she saw this as entrapment, and I think at the time it was unimaginable to her that she'd actually spend 5 years because she saw it as entrapment.
Well, hindsight is indeed 20/20.
Do you think that any of the Rockefeller drug laws were based on false assumptions about what the long prison stays would accomplish and about what it would be like on the other end when people got out?
Well, I think that the Rockefeller drug laws were a reaction to a failed drug policy that preceded it. The Drug Control Commission was an exercise in futility. It was a failure. And the legislature, in a reaction to the complete and total failure of drug policy in New York State, took a get tough approach to the drug laws. Now, there are many individuals who feel that that get-tough approach to the drug problem was an overreaction, and I think that's a legitimate criticism. But to say that everyone who's involved in drugs needs treatment, or that sole discretion in sentencing for someone who has 2 or 3 prior felony convictions and is caught again selling drugs should rest with a judge, that's not really helping the debate. I think that what really needs to happen is that all the stakeholders in the system, whether it's the criminal justice system, the drug treatment system, should all try to get together and try to fashion a policy which reflects what people feel is the appropriate sanction for an individual who sells dangerous drugs. And if it's a life sentence for a kingpin, well, so be it. But that's not what's on the table right now, and that's really what's unfortunate. And at some level, people such as Elaine Bartlett, who have a very compelling story to tell, they are clearly not representative of who goes to jail in New York State for drugs. And it's unfortunate that she's being used in the debate because it's not an accurate reflection of really what's going on in New York and who's going to jail for drugs. The people who are going to jail for drugs are drug sellers who don't use drugs and who sell drugs simply to make money.
You've pointed out that Elaine Bartlett is atypical of the people convicted under the Rockefeller drug laws, but isn't part of the point of reform to make sure that people like Elaine Bartlett, the people who are the exceptions, who aren't typical, aren't a victim of the laws?
Well, again, as I indicated early on, the most state DAs agree that there should be something done to ameliorate the potentially harsh sentences involving a case like Elaine Bartlett. But that's not what the reform movement is content with at this point. The reason there has been no, quote, reform in New York State is because that's not what's on the table. The individuals that are pushing reform want to go well beyond the Elaine Bartlett situation.
Paul Klein is the district attorney for New York's Albany County. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, presenting the weekly original series Anatomy of a Scene with the making of Saved, starring Jenna Malone and Macaulay Culkin, tonight at 9. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, A River of Blood. We talk with Simon Sebag Montefiore about his new book, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the Americanization of Benjamin Franklin. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The atrocities in the Soviet Union under the regime of Joseph Stalin have been well documented. During the Great Terror, 1.5 million people were arrested and 700,000 were shot. A new book focuses on the tyranny within Stalin's inner circle. My guest, Simon Sebag Montefiore, is the author of Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. Historian Richard Pipes describes it as the first intimate portrait of Stalin. The book is based on recently opened Russian archives containing Stalin's letters, as well as those of the members of his inner circle and their families. Montefiore also interviewed the children and grandchildren of the members of the inner circle. I asked him to describe what he found in the Russian archive.
When I arrived to start researching it in about 2000, I arrived at the party archive, the Communist Party archive, and they said, "You're in luck. We're opening half of Stalin's own papers now." So these papers that that I've based the book on are, in fact, the first inner view of how the Kremlin worked, how Stalin's private life worked. So it contains things not only such as the memorandum in which Stalin and Molotov and the others ordered their subordinates to kill about 1 million people by quota, not even by name. For example, that's one side of it, which is the serious documents that show how they actually were responsible for these vast crimes. But the other side of it is intimate papers, Stalin's love letters to his wife, his wife's love letters to him, Molotov's love letters to his wife and vice versa, Stalin's jokes and drawings, Stalin's notes to his comrades. I mean, one of the things that this book shows is how intimate this little group was.
I'm interested in the memo to kill by quota. How did that memo read?
It reads something like this. We order you to kill enemies of the people, and we order you to kill them by quota. So you in Minneapolis kill 20,000. You in Philadelphia kill 40,000. Los Angeles and Seattle each, you kill 25,000 each. That's it. And it goes through every city and every region of the whole vast Soviet empire. And, of course, the Bolsheviks, the interesting thing about it was that the Bolsheviks were very at home with this idea of killing by quota. But this one I'm talking about in 1937 was really aimed at it wiping out a strata of the ruling Bolshevik class, whom Stalin felt had got soft, insubordinate, and insufficiently committed to the cause.
What was going on in Stalin's private life when he wrote this memo?
His wife had committed suicide, and I begin the book with the suicide. Then after that, he'd had an affair with his sister-in-law, in other words, his wife's brother's wife, if you can follow that. And one of the amazing things I found in the archive was actually a photograph, which had never been published before, which is in the book, of Stalin beaming, surrounded by all his favourite women, and his feet sitting between his legs is this woman, Zhenya, grinning up at the camera like the cat that's got the cream. But by 1937, that relationship was also over, and that was a great secret relationship. And in 1937, he began to settle down into secret intimacy with Valechka, who was his housekeeper and maid, and that was a much less equal relationship than any had gone before. But Stalin believed that his private life was dead. He couldn't afford to have anyone really know what was happening in his life. And therefore he'd retired, as it were, to that sort of relationship.
As you mentioned, you start the book with the suicide of his wife, and this was in 1932. She shot herself at the end of a dinner party that the Stalins were giving in their home. How do you think his life was changed by his wife's suicide in 1932?
I don't think the terror was caused by her suicide. And you've got to realize that Stalin was already a mass murderer by then, but so were all the people round him. And certainly it's true to say that the terror was partly formed by Stalin's character, and therefore Stalin's character was certainly partly formed by the suicide of his wife. So it was a contributing factor, and especially towards his attitude to the wives and women of other leaders. And later he would execute and terrorize many of the wives. And that was partly from jealousy that they were happily married and he was now alone, and partly from suspicion that wives could no longer be relied upon.
How many wives in his court do you think he had executed?
Well, I mean, he certainly had two wives very close of people very close to him, his secretary and one of his top marshals. They were executed in the most disgusting manner. I mean, one of them was actually kidnapped on the same day that her husband was promoted to Marshal of the Soviet Union. The newly appointed Marshal of the Soviet Union then went to see the head of the secret police, Beria, and said to him, "Where's my wife, do you know?" And she was a very beautiful woman, incidentally. And Beria said, "No, of course not, but why don't we ring up Stalin, see if he knows?" So they rang Stalin, and he said, "I've got Marshal Kulik here with me in the office, and he wants to know where his wife is. Do you know?" And then he put the phone down. He said, "Comrade Stalin doesn't know either." And, of course, all the time, both Stalin and Beria knew that the wife was several floors below them in her cell, waiting to be shot in the back of the head for nothing. For nothing. She was shot just in the back of the head, casually, and she was tried and convicted of nothing. And she was 28 years old and utterly beautiful. And this is the sort of... This is the way that the men around him had to live. This is the way the Bolsheviks had to live.
How do you know for sure that Stalin knew that this woman was a few floors below in a cell about to be executed?
Well, we know that from paperwork in the secret police paperwork and from the memories of people when they were arrested after Stalin's death that he'd ordered it and that Beria and him had arranged it.
How many members of Stalin's court would you say were executed?
Well, I mean, if you think of the sort of the top 100, I mean, the Bolsheviks were a tiny group. You know, when they seized power, there were about 5,000 Bolsheviks, which gives you an idea of the tininess of this little almost fanatical religious sect. The actual ruling section of the party was about 100 people, and by Stalin's time, it was, say, 50 people. And that was called the Central Committee. And that he shot the sort of majority of the Central Committee. So, you know, I mean, of his inner circle, of the people he knew very well, you know, he killed over half. And when I mentioned that they killed 1 million people by quota, they also killed 40,000 people by name. And this case, Stalin would be sent albums, as they were called in Russia, which was a little biography of the person, a photo of them, hence the name albums, and, you know, sentenced to death. And Stalin could either put a dash next to it, and that meant preserve them, don't shoot them, keep them in prison, or he could put a note or an insulting comment next to them, like just beat them or, you know, kill them. And he'd often pass it around the Politburo, and they'd all write things on.
Can you give us a sense of what the culture was like in Stalin's inner circle, where people knew that they might be executed by their boss?
I think most of the people believed that they would be all right because surely somehow there was some sort of reason behind it. But those that really knew understood that these people were really being killed for lack of faith. So there was a huge random nature to this. Some people just survived because they were lucky. Some people just, on a whim, Stalin ticked their name. And many people, you know, Stalin said, "Is that guy still alive? I can't remember if we signed his death warrant or not." And was rather disappointed when he found out they'd been shot. So, yes, these people knew that they could be killed at any minute. And they believed that was right. They believed that the party was always right. The only way to understand them, and I've read all their letters and I've begun to understand this, is that they were religious fanatics who believed it was right to die for the cause, that family and friends were nothing compared with the cause, and the cause was what they called history. So it sounded very scientific, but in actual fact, it was really a religious fanaticism, and that's the only way to understand it.
It's interesting that you describe it as religious fanaticism because you weren't allowed to practice religion as we know it in the Soviet Union then. But you're saying that the ideology of Stalinism was almost a substitute for extreme religion.
Oh, yes, and almost openly. And they talked about it in that way, too. I mean, the way they talked about themselves was constantly as knights in shining armor who would die for the cause of justice and so on. I mean, you know, they believed that you had to kill a certain number of people now in order to create a deferred paradise later. That was their basic belief. But they saw themselves as a sort of religious military order.
My guest is Simon Sebag Montefiore, the author of Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Simon Sebag Montefiore. He's the author of the new book, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. Now, Stalin apparently loved the arts, which I suppose goes to show that the arts aren't necessarily ennobling. You say Stalin micromanaged the theater as he dominated cinema, literature, and politics. In what sense did he micromanage the theater?
Well, I mean, just an example from the cinema, if I may, just as part of that answer to that question.
Sure.
I mean, one of the things I found was fascinating was that, you know, not only had he named most of the films and viewed most of the films and worked on their scripts, but I found he was also writing the songs, the lyrics for some of the songs. So he sort of fancied himself as a sort of Rodgers and Hammerstein of Soviet musicals.
You quote a song lyric that Stalin wrote for one of the movies, and it's a cheerful little lyric. This is the English translation of it that you give in your book. A joyful song is easy for the heart. It doesn't bore you ever. And all the villages, small and big, adore the song. Big towns love the tune. A song lyric by Joseph Stalin. Now, you say that Stalin told the writers in the Soviet Union to become engineers of human souls. What did that mean to Stalin?
It meant it doesn't matter how bad a writer you were expected, or how good for that matter. Politics was absolutely supreme. And in this case, these writers were expected to show how life should be, not how life was. And Stalin, engineers of the human soul, is a typical Stalin phrase, and I think he coined himself.
And now a famous phrase.
Yeah, now a very famous phrase. And he actually had them to this kind of dinner, and he told them that this was what they were to do. And he understood genius all right. I mean, in one sense, he understood very well. For example, he famously called Boris Pasternak to discuss the famous poet Osip Mandelstam, two of the great poets of his time. And he understood that both of them were geniuses. In fact, he said so. But he regarded them as apolitical geniuses. When Mandelstam made a poem against Stalin, in which he mocked Stalin, then he crossed the line and was moved, as it were, off the precipice, in which he became a nothing in that world. But about Dostoevsky, he famously said, you know, Dostoevsky's a genius. No one understands human psychology like Dostoevsky, said Stalin, and that's why we've banned him completely in the Soviet Union. And that tells you a lot about his attitude. But he read all the time. I mean, I've been through his library. One of the things in this amazing archive is his library. And he annotates everything. He writes, sometimes he writes rather gruesomely, ha, 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 beside things he thought were quite funny. Other times he wrote things like, green steam, exclamation mark. But he read everything. If he was doing politics or statesmanship, he would read up about the person. So when he was negotiating with Hitler, he would read about Bismarck. When he was negotiating with Churchill, he read about Churchill's ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, the great Duke of Marlborough. And he was obsessed with reading, and in fact, he loved novels. He'd read his Balzac and his Zola. He loved Zola. And of course, the most surprising ones, he'd read the Forsyte Saga, which all the Politburo read and liked. And of course, they loved Last of the Mohicans. And Stalin, in fact, used to often put on what he called a sort of American native Indian voice and say, hello, hello, pale face, me big red chief, which, of course, is just extraordinary.
What were his favorite movies?
He loved John Wayne movies. He loved cowboy films. He particularly liked the films directed by John Ford. I think he associated with cowboy films especially because he regarded himself as a special person, a messiah, someone different from other people, someone always traveled alone. He regarded himself almost as without family, without attachments, a man who just could fulfill his historical role. And I think he rather felt himself rather like the cowboy that rides alone into a town, the man with no name almost, you know, who rides into a town and settles its, gives justice to its people ruthlessly. That's how he saw himself.
Did he think that the movies and books that he loved gave the kind of message that he insisted that the writers and the filmmakers in his world create?
That he loved himself? Oh, no. I mean, he understood. He was an immensely subtle person. He understood perfectly well that he could love many books and he read everything, but the people shouldn't be allowed to read anything that wasn't politically useful. And that applied to everything, by the way, films and cinema and so on. I mean, he would decide. He believed that history had given him the right to decide these things, and that he loved many books that in the end he banned, you know.
Stalin and Hitler were two of the great monsters of their time, two of the great monsters of the century. Were there interesting things in Stalin's papers about what he thought of Hitler?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's interesting. I mean, Hitler, he did get wrong. He wasn't that he didn't think Hitler would attack him. I mean, he believed that there'd be war by about 1943, but he thought he could put it off by then. And he thought he understood Hitler, and he was wrong. What he thought of Hitler was, I mentioned that he used to read continually about the subjects that were important to him at that time. So he was reading about Bismarck. And Bismarck always said, Germany will never go to war, should never go to war on two fronts. And, you know, he believed that Hitler was a great power politician, a real politician like himself, who wouldn't do anything so foolish. And in fact, he used to say quite often, gosh, you know, does Hitler really think that Russia is a country like, you know, England or France or Poland that you can just take like that? He said, you know, doesn't he realise we're five times bigger than that and we have such resources? He couldn't believe Hitler would be so stupid as to attack him. And the most revealing thing, I found this out in Georgia. I mean, I went down to Georgia a lot and found many other new materials apart from the archives. But one of the things I found there was this fascinating just nugget of history where Stalin, for the only time in his career, talked about the mistake he'd made in Hitler. And he said, you know, my mistake was to believe that he was someone like myself. And what he meant was that he thought Hitler was a normal politician. In fact, Hitler himself described himself as a sleepwalker, a gambler. Stalin wasn't like that in international affairs. He was actually very cautious, and so that's what he got wrong.
Do you think Stalin saw any similarities between himself and Hitler as people who were mass murderers and who had this ideology that ruled everything in their lives?
Yes and no. He had contempt for Nazism because Nazism actually was much more, it was really the worship of power and the glamour of power. So he regarded that as very crass, while Marxism and Leninism was this international ideal to improve humanity. So he regarded that as much superior. But he did regard Hitler as someone who, like himself, was a ruthless and brilliant statesman and a man who could get things done. And we know, for example, that when Hitler killed all his opponents in 1934 in the Night of the Long Knives, Stalin said to his rather surprised companions, he said, that's a clever man, that Hitler. He knows how to get things done and get rid of his people and his enemies. And, of course, that was a lesson that Stalin took to heart.
I doubt Stalin would have objected to Hitler's fear and hatred of the Jews and his attempts to exterminate all of them.
I don't know. I don't think Stalin necessarily wanted to exterminate the Jews. He always was very suspicious of the Jews because, various reasons. One was that, you know, he wanted everyone to belong, and he was actually a sort of nationalist in many ways, a Russian nationalist. Jews didn't belong, didn't have loyalty to only one source of authority. So that was one reason. Another reason was that Stalin's opponents were overwhelmingly Jewish intellectuals, like Trotsky, the best example. But one often forgets that right up until Stalin's death, some of his closest colleagues were Jews. Some of his whole secretariat virtually was Jewish. But after the war, then Stalin became a real anti-Semite, a real frenzied anti-Semite. And the reason for this was that Israel was founded. He began to see that many of the people around him, the wives, for example, Molotov's wife, had a dual fidelity, partly to Marxism, Leninism and Soviet Russia, but partly to Israel too. And he became very suspicious of this. And when Israel turned out to be an American ally, he began to see this as a useful political tool, and that Jews were all around him. And he could wipe out people near him, like Molotov, by using it. He could also rally the Soviet Union again by using this internal enemy. And he did become a frenzied anti-Semite then.
Did Stalin ever write in his letters or in other papers that you've read how he hoped history would remember him?
Not specifically, but it was clear that how he saw himself. I mean, he wanted people to remember him as a pitiless, brutal, but enormously successful man who created Marxism, Leninism, in the Soviet Empire, and from Berlin to Mongolia, who used his military talents as a warlord to win the war against Hitler, a man who had created a new form of arts, a new form of cinema. That was how he wanted to remember it, and as a czar, as the most powerful czar the Russian people ever had. So he was always these two things. On one hand, Marxism, Leninism, this idealism. On the other hand, great power politics and history.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Simon Sebag Montefiore is the author of Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the Americanization of Benjamin Franklin. This is Fresh Air. He was a statesman on the world stage, an intellectual, and, admittedly, a philanderer. And he's the subject of a new book. No, we're not talking about Bill Clinton, but rather Benjamin Franklin. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of a new book on Franklin by the renowned American historian Gordon S. Wood. It's called The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin.
You'd think by now enough is enough with Ben Franklin. Walter Isaacson's biography of Franklin was the nonfiction sensation of last year. It's only about the gazillionth biography of Franklin to be written since his death in 1790 at age 84. Franklin's own autobiography is quite likely still the most widely read American autobiography. And even during his lifetime, Franklin's face was ubiquitous, emblazoned on medallions, snuff boxes, handkerchiefs, and chamber pots. Now along comes yet another excavation into Franklin's life, this one called The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin, written by one of our foremost scholars of the American Revolution, Gordon S. Wood. Against the odds, Wood's new study of Franklin is a revelatory book, not only because it upends so many received notions about our craftiest founding father, but also because it demonstrates how thrilling the scholarly pursuit of elusive truth can be. First, a disclaimer, since I've used that attention-annihilating word, scholarly. Although Wood is, of course, scrupulous in grounding his arguments in primary and secondary sources, The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin is a lively book, democratically written for every reader. The upshot of Wood's book is not to denigrate Franklin, as so many of his critics have done over the past two centuries, but to help readers understand and ultimately marvel at him all the more. Wood points out in his introduction that Franklin seems the most accessible, the most democratic, the most folksy of the founders. But one of the key corrections to popular ideas about Franklin's character that Wood makes here is that during his lifetime, Franklin, with his own hearty consent, was celebrated as an inventor, diplomat, and cultivated man of the world. Franklin certainly didn't hide his origins as a lowly printer, but his enduring image as a self-made man, Wood says, only began to emerge in America in the early 19th century and signaled a radical shift in attitudes towards social mobility and the dignity of manual labor. It was the French, Wood says, who first began to manufacture the image of Franklin as a kind of rustic savant during the years he spent as a delegate to France seeking that country's vital support for the American Revolution. Since Franklin was from Pennsylvania, the French assumed he was a Quaker, and Franklin played the part to perfection, wearing plain white and brown linen and unpowdered hair. Thus, he became for the French a symbol of Republican simplicity. One of the funniest sections of Wood's book, by the way, is his discussion of how the infatuated French revered Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac, treating that hodgepodge collection of truisms as sublime moral philosophy. The major revelation in Wood's book is just how un-American Franklin was throughout most of his long life. Up until the eve of the Revolution, he was a royalist. He adored England and lived there throughout his 50s and 60s for a total of 15 years. As Wood suspensefully describes it, the process by which Franklin became one of the most passionate patriots was lightning quick, but still too complex to do justice to here. Let's just say it had to do with politics as well as personal humiliation. Once he became a revolutionary around the age of 70, Franklin was fierce, even cutting off his formerly loving relations with his only son, William, who was the royal governor of New Jersey. After the peace treaty with Britain was signed in 1783, William requested a reconciliation with his father, but Franklin, in a letter, offered little hope. "Nothing," he wrote, "has ever hurt me so much and affected me with such keen sensations as to find myself deserted in my old age by my only son, and not only deserted, but to find him taking up arms against me in a cause wherein my good fame, fortune, and life were all at stake." That's arguably the most remarkable aspect of Franklin's life story that Wood highlights here. Franklin was the oldest of the founders, as well as the most famous American in the world. And yet, in his old age, he risked everything on a revolution of colonists against the world's most powerful empire. As Franklin himself might have observed in his almanac, maybe it is possible for an old dog to learn new tricks after all.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin by Gordon S. Wood. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Henry Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by TIAA CREF, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Roberts and Israel Goldvich about their new documentary, Suicide Bomber, which will be shown Thursday on the PBS series Wide Angle. It features interviews filmed in Israeli prisons with failed suicide bombers, a recruiter, and a bomb maker. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.